So if you're with us yesterday for the homeschool sessions, it might be a little bit of review, but this time we're going to go much more rapid fire, because this question is really an application of everything we've learned, and an excellent application because it's such a hot topic. Our research director was just interviewed on CNN, I think Wolf Blitzer's Situation Room or one of these CNN shows, and I forget what prompted this interview. And, of course, they went to Bill Nye, the science guy, and said, someone must have made a claim contrary to evolution. So they went to Bill Nye, the science guy. What do you say? Well, you know, that's ridiculous. We know the Earth is old, radiometric dating, fossils. And of course, made all his claims, and our guy, Jason Lyle, got maybe 10 seconds, even though he was interviewed and refuted every one of those points. Liberal news for you. But what was interesting to me was Bill Nye, when he was saying, here's the evidence, we have radiometric dating, we have light from distant stars, and dinosaurs. No explanation. As if the existence of dinosaurs somehow, by itself, validated evolution and older thinking. Not that they were old, not that they died out, just dinosaurs. That was the explanation. So a hot topic, what's the rapid-fire answer to this? Now we're going to think biblically in a bunch of different questions. I'll explore some of the other topics we weren't able to touch in great depth in the earlier sessions as they arise, but here's how we can think biblically and answer the question quickly, starting with Scripture, looking for those big effects, and we can take some of those big effects from the previous lectures, and then refuting contrary claims. So, number of questions, not rapid fire. One of these guys, one of these big beasts live. They weren't created to deceive us, but we know that they were created along with every other creature during the creation week, days 5 and 6, 6 to 10,000 years ago. So, everything from Tyrannosaurus to Brachiosaurus to Plesiosaurus created during this week, which means they walked with man, which of course is a direct attack on the popular notion that they died out millions of years ago. Scripture and evolution and older thinking cannot be harmonized. So day 5, God creates great sea creatures, including Plesiosaur, every living thing that moves with which the waters abounded. There's an inclusive category that would include swimming dinosaurs. Every winged bird according to its kind. So dinosaurs were made after their kind, too. We'll return to that when we come to the flood. So everything in the air, Pteranodon, Pterodactyl, everything in the sea, Plesiosaurus, Mosasaur, all these creatures created days 5 and 6. Day 5. Day 6, of course, every beast of the field, cattle, everything that creeps on the earth. So wild dinosaurs, domestic dinosaurs, large and small, all created day 6. So Stegosaurus, Diplodocus, Tyrannosaurus, Allosaurus, you name it. So, what's the big effects in the natural world? We can take one from last night. How do we know that the universe is young? You can go to the Taking Back Astronomy book. But we can see comets in our solar system. They don't last very long. The solar system can't be that old if there are comets in our universe, like walking into a sauna, seeing an ice cream cone. No evidence of an Oort cloud that could keep spinning off comets to replace the ones that burn out. What about light from distant stars? We discussed this last night as well. A number of different explanations. The key assumption that undergirds this attack is that we know the one-way speed of light, and we don't. No one can measure it because of the constraints of Einstein's physics. Even Einstein admitted you can't measure the one-way speed of light. Could get here instantaneously, not an argument against a recent creation. And of course, we just covered radiometric dating in great detail. Doesn't work on Mount St. Helens, never been validated to work. Gives the wrong ages for rocks of known age. It's inaccurate, inconsistent, totally impossible. So one of these guys lived 6 to 10,000 years ago, perfectly consistent with all the science that we know. Next question, what did they eat? This really gets to the sticky question of, well, what about God's character? Would he create a Tyrannosaurus with this set of jaws? In the beginning, they all ate plants, at Genesis 1:30. So here we can discuss this aspect of the curse that we didn't get to discuss in great depth earlier. So here's a T-Rex tooth. It doesn't have to be used to eat meat. Well, here's a skull of a panda bear. If you didn't know that, you might look at those canines and conclude that maybe he eats meat, but it strictly survives in bamboo. This ferocious-looking creature is a bat, but it's a fruit bat. It uses those sharp teeth to strip through plants. You're going to need some pretty sharp teeth to crack a watermelon or a coconut. So they all ate plants in the beginning, and the question then arises, where did the T-Rex get his teeth? Where did the shark get his teeth? We mentioned in the earlier lecture, species look deadly But how do they go from being very good to ferocious carnivores? That's one of the research questions I was just working on with a colleague last week, and there's I mentioned this to someone last night, but it's worthy of mentioning publicly. At least four hypotheses on how carnivorous structures, and I'm just going to make a big category, how all the biological nasties arise. So this includes, again, ferocious predators, pathogens, microbes, parasites. How did all these things go from being very good to nasty? So one explanation is repurposing. But they had a good purpose that we don't realize now, and they've been repurposed then to kill and destroy. That may be one explanation. For pathogens, it may be a change in environment, so that creation was initially very good in perfect harmony. God sustained it exactly. He may have withheld now, today, some of his sustaining hand, so that E. coli, which can be very good in your gut, maybe related to whether or not you get diabetes, helps in digestion, if it crosses the wall of your gut, now is potentially life-threatening. Change in environment. Anthrax you can find in the soil. Anthrax in your body is deadly. So it may be that that harmonious organismal environment interaction was disrupted at the fall. And that may be a mechanism by which we get some of these nasties. So change in purpose, change in environment, it may be latent genetic information. What do I mean by latent genetic information? Let's ask a different question. Where does the immune system come from? So the purpose of the immune system seems to protect us from the nasties. So did Adam have an immune system? Here's an interesting answer that comes straight from my PhD work. So I was working on blood stem cells. There is one cell that gives rise to your red blood cells. It's a stem cell. It gives rise to platelets, red blood cells, white blood cells, T cells, B cells, the whole nine yards. And there are a few genetic switches that determine whether this stem cell is going to become a red blood cell, which you're going to need all the time just to breathe, or an immune attack cell. So could it be that some genetic switch got flipped at the curse, and now we started making immune cells? Could it be that some genetic switch got flipped at the curse, and now the teeth get sharper? Here's another aspect of it that we alluded to in the earlier lecture. So we've got fairly ferocious carnivores, lions and tigers, related to the tame kitty cats. They all have a common ancestor. So where did that aggressive behavior come from? It's one aspect of a bigger group. And it could be that they were all tame before the fall. The information was present, and just how you mix and match it post-fall, post-flood, determines how ferocious you are. Another example of latent genetic information. Let me give you an even more fascinating example that isn't directly related to aggressive behavior. It's in plants. So there's two species of sunflower that have totally different biochemistries. So photosynthesis, of course, is a really complicated biological process. Very complex biochemistry. You can imagine that if you're a plant living in the desert, you're going to have a totally different biochemistry. You're going to need to conserve water. If you're in a tropical environment, the biochemistry is totally different. Totally different mechanism of photosynthesis. Now, if you were to look at this, and you might say, wow, these are really well designed. I bet you God created them separately. Remember that kinds are identified by breeding. The two plants can interbreed. And there's a simple genetic switch between the two. And let me make one more point. So we don't know what the pre-flood world looked like exactly. Scripture is silent. If you look at the fossil record, which is a record likely of the pre-flood world, there are some amazing plants and creatures that we don't see today. It may be that the environment was entirely tropical, one landmass, before the flood. Now, could it be that these sunflowers never saw a desert environment until the flood hit? That could be. Which means God programmed them with the information to survive an environment they wouldn't see for 2,000 years. So there's some indirect evidence of front-loading of genetic information that becomes expressed when needed. So that same thing might be applied to a stickier question, the question of God's judgment at the curse. Maybe latent genetic information that doesn't get expressed until after sin. So repurposing, change in environment, latent genetic information, the last explanation would be degeneration. So something like mycoplasma, it's got a very small complement of DNA dependent upon a host. may have been something good and self-existent in a sense, not dependent, in the beginning. It may not have been a parasite. You can find, you know, there's some strains of E. coli that are more pathogenic than others. They can pass around resistance to antibiotics. So especially when it comes to microbes, some of the pathogenic activity we see may be simply mutations and degeneration from some originally good purpose. God's lifted his sustaining hand. It's not just a change in environment, but their basic genetic nature has changed and degenerated such that they're dependent now upon a host, obligate parasites or pathogens. So all those explanations are at play. Now here, let me give you one more example that just showed up this last week. My colleague Frank Sherwin is a parasitologist by training, and he was looking at the mosquito. So this comes up commonly as an objection against the young earth model. Why would God design an insect with biting with mouth parts that seem designed to suck your blood? Or why didn't Noah swat the mosquito on the ark? Where did that come from? So there are a number of questions at play. One is, well, what family does he belong to? Can the mosquito breed with another insect that's not sucking our blood? Here's something else to consider that you just found out this last week. So aphids have a similar mouth part that sucks the sap of plants. Plants must also transport, so here's why mosquitoes are nasty. They can carry malaria. It's malaria, or I think it's malaria that'll eat the hemoglobin in your blood. So how did this complex life cycle arise with the mosquito as a host? Well, aphids can suck plant sap. It's a legitimate means of feeding. There is a form of hemoglobin in plants, because after all, you know, we breathe in oxygen, breathe out carbon dioxide. They do the reverse. They still have to transport oxygen and move it. And there's a version of hemoglobin. So here's a very non-pathogenic, non-bothersome biochemistry that seems very close to ours, and it may not take much to convert something like an aphid to a nasty like a mosquito. So all of these mechanisms at play, and so this isn't a problem for young earth creation. These T-Rex teeth, we don't know what kind to which the T-Rex belonged. There may be a non-ferocious type of T-Rex, and maybe those teeth were used for something else. So an active research question, something we're thinking about right now, and again, Acts and Facts will tell you as we find stuff out. So this is not a problem. Really fascinating mechanisms at play. The fact that these nasties exist is a sign of God's judgment. These guys ate plants in the beginning, and then after the curse, began to kill each other. And of course, as we mentioned earlier, these guys didn't die and didn't start killing each other until sin entered for the reasons we mentioned. Genesis 2, God says to Adam and Eve, when you eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you'll surely die. The Hebrew is dying, you will die, and that answers a common objection. People say, well, they didn't die that day. You can't take Genesis literally. Well, literally, it says, dying, they will die. And the day they ate of it, they were kicked out of the garden and began dying. That's the end of Genesis 3. God says, it seems like God interrupts himself. And now, lest they reach and take of the tree of life and eat and live forever, and the verse stops, as if it's too terrible a thought to consider even further, and God sends them out so that they won't live eternally in separation from him, so that they will eventually die. And of course, we discussed the huge problems in terms of the gospel if you have death before sin. Destroys the Mosaic Law, which really undercuts the gospel. It can't have animal death before sin. Where do their fossils come from? We talked about five facts that really point towards a recent global flood catastrophe. Flood seems the most likely explanation, not only for fossils below us here, but T-Rex in Montana, all the dinosaur fossils. Here was the slide I didn't have earlier. It has to be a global flood because God promises to never send one like it again. We covered that earlier. Can't be a local flood. We see good evidence of it. Going through this progression again, how do we know that there's evidence of the flood? You take someone to the beach, you show them the globe. There is evidence of the global flood of Noah. That's what should be discussed first, even before we get to the fossil record. The flood happened. That's the first question. Did it happen or not? If you're discussing with someone, if they say no, take them here. Lots of evidence for it. Skip these slides as review. But what about dinosaurs on the ark? Could they have fit on the ark with their enormous size? What does Scripture say? Make yourself an ark of gopher wood and of every living thing of all flesh. And of course, God makes it more specific and says, limits it to the land, air-breathing creatures. But there are a lot of land, air-breathing dinosaurs that would seem to fall into that category, and at first pass may seem to not fit into the ark. So what's the answer to that? First answer is that the ark is enormous. It has the capacity of 522 railroad cars. There's an elephant. So there's three decks in this ark. Someone asked me about this book. There's a great book, Noah's Ark, a feasibility study. John Woodmorappy calculated in great and gory detail how much space there was on the ark, how many animals went on the ark, how much feed they would need, how much waste they would need, how they would make, and how you'd get rid of it, how much fresh water you need to take on the ark. Every detail you could think of, he calculated, and the bottom line is there was plenty of room for the animals and for the people. Not just Noah and his family, plenty of room for those who rejected his message. And of course, that's a picture of today, where there's so much room, the gospel's offered to all, and so many reject it. Not like there's not enough room in heaven. They could be saved, but they reject it. Now, average dinosaur size, another factor to consider, is not a brachiosaurus. That's not the rule. Average size is about a pony. There are some dinosaurs that were quite tiny. Here's a chicken and a mouse for comparison. So how did the dinosaurs get on the ark? Common objection. Well, first, the boat was big. Secondly, the dinosaurs weren't as big as we thought they were. And thirdly, Noah probably didn't take the big great-great-granddaddies. Reptiles just keep growing. So when you see this enormous brachiosaurus in the fossil record, one of them is on display at O'Hare Airport, which I've flown through, neck through the ceiling. It's just huge. That's not the rule. Those are probably great-great-granddaddies, and Noah probably didn't take them. Why? Because of size constraints? No. The purpose of bringing them on the ark is to preserve their offspring. Grandparents aren't going to have the reproductive capacity that juveniles will, so Noah probably took the juveniles, which as a secondary consequence means he probably took the smaller ones. Maybe even could have taken dinosaur eggs and they'd have reproduced after the flood. And of course, the concept we discussed in detail this morning, kinds were taken, not species. So however many dinosaur species there are, the number of kinds is something less. Something else to note about paleontology. How do you define what a species is in paleontology if it's dead and all you have are the bones? There's a debate in paleontology as to what constitutes a triceratops, and if a triceratops is different from one of these other horned dinosaurs, or if one of these species is just a juvenile form. Is there a T-Rex and then a different version of it? Are some of these other species of T-Rex-like creatures different species, or juvenile T-Rexes? So even in the secular community, there's debate over what species means. Whenever they figure out what it means, the number of families taken on the ark, the kinds, is something less. There could have been only a few dinosaurs. There may be a sauropod kind, the big four-legged ones, only two, and a theropod kind. There may only be a few kinds of dinosaurs. So they all would have fit quite easily along with all the rest of the land air-breathing animals. And all the rest of the dinosaurs would have died in the flood. We see good evidence that their fossils are flood-caused because these marine creatures constitute 95 out of 100 of them. Textbook diagrams don't depict it accurately. This column does. And, of course, we can see soft tissue even in Montana. So the state of Montana, a strong argument for recent creation and a recent fossil record. So when did dinosaurs live? Created days 5 and 6 in the recent past, 6 to 10,000 years ago. They ate plants in the beginning. Through mechanisms we're currently researching, they began to kill each other and began to develop these predatory structures. Two of every kind went on the ark. Those who were not on the ark died in the flood. Now, where in the fossil record the flood layers end and the post-flood layers start is a matter of debate. So Mount St. Helens, here we have some post-flood layers that have formed. So where in that Paleozoic, Cenozoic, Mesozoic sequence does flood stop and post-flood begin? And it's not clear. In the book that we don't have here, but that I alluded to earlier, Earth's Catastrophic Past, Andrew Snelling, the author, discusses some of that. I think most of the young Earth geologists would say where the dinosaurs go extinct, typically, in secular thinking, that's the end of the flood. Post-flood begins up here, but there are other views. So it's still an active research question. Catastrophe, though, is the unifying rule among all of these views in the young Earth community. Catastrophe is the cause, not slow and gradual change. Now, if dinosaurs were created in days 5 and 6, that necessarily implies they walked with man. Again, total heresy in today's culture. But we can make it even more penetrating an argument. So they walked with man before the flood. They walked with man onto the ark. They must have walked with man off the ark and post-flood. So there may even be some alive today, theoretically. How do we know that they walked with man? Just logically thinking from the flood account. But also there's biblical evidence, I think, of mankind's and dinosaurs' coexistence in the book of Job. So, and this is a point of controversy, so the exegesis here is key. You know the story of Job. Satan comes to God and says he wants to destroy Job, make Job curse God. And God says, no, Job is going to be the model of faith in me. So he lets Satan destroy everything Job has, essentially. Takes away his livelihood, even tries to destroy his body with sores. So Job is miserable, never curses God. And most of the book is his friends debating him on what the cause is, because they don't know the conversation that God and Satan just had. And finally, at the end, God breaks his silence and speaks. Doesn't tell Job the reason. Somehow, whoever the author of Job is found out. But all God says is, why are you questioning me? That's essentially the argument. And he does it by appealing to nature. Do you know where snow comes from? Well, yes, it comes through the condensation and freezing, and that's not the question. Do you know where the snow comes from? Do you know the mountain goat gives birth? And with example after example from the natural world, God humbles Job and says, you don't understand the half of what you can see out there. Why do you question me with what I'm doing with you? It's a sobering and heavy argument. But in the midst of that argument is where these two creatures show up. So remember, the context is stuff Job can see that no one would question as real. When it gets to these two creatures, there seems to be debate and people question whether or not they're real. Context says they are, and even the verse, look now at the behemoth. Behold, behemoth, something Job can see. Which I made along with you. See now his strength is in his hips, and his power is in his stomach muscles. He moves his tail like a cedar. This is a powerful beast. The sinews of his thighs are tightly knit. Bones are like beams of bronze, ribs like bars of iron. Now, some Bible notes will say, like I had an NIV back in the day that said, this is a elephant or hippo. Next time you see an elephant or hippo, take a look at the backside. Not too long. But see if that tail looks like a cedar tree. There's the hippo. Doesn't look like a cedar tree to me. Now you look at a sauropod dinosaur. Ooh. It's a massive end to that body. So it sounds like Job is looking at some sort of sauropod. Nothing we see today. Nothing we see today has a tail like a cedar tree that fits the description. The second creature that I want to draw your attention to is this one called Leviathan. A fire-breathing creature. Some say, oh, people, because we don't see fire-breathing creatures today, they say, oh, this is mythology, this is just figurative language. Context says no. This is all stuff Job can see. Out of his mouth go burning lights, sparks of fire shoot out, smoke goes out of his nostrils, a flame goes out of his mouth. Not a creature you want to mess with. And not a crocodile or an alligator. I've never seen them breathe fire. If you have, let me know. And we can go look at it together. Because I think that's pretty cool. Probably not. Maybe a plesiosaur. Why would I say a plesiosaur? Well, this is a waterborne creature. Some of the skulls of these extinct, apparently extinct reptiles have fenestrae or openings. The purpose of which we don't know. We know there was a fire-breathing creature, because Job saw it. Doesn't seem to exist today. Now, how would a creature breathe fire? Maybe chemically, and maybe that's the purpose of those openings in the skull. So the bombardier beetle, you may have heard of, shoots a scalding hot liquid out its backside. Now, if he was maintaining 212 degrees Fahrenheit in his abdomen, I don't think he'd last very long. So how does he shoot scalding hot liquid? Chemically, he's got peroxide, I think, in one of his compartments, and the catalyst probably in the other, mixes them in his backside and comes shooting out, and he's unharmed. So chemically, he creates this heat and isn't fire. But that's an example of how you could produce something that would kill you, or contain the means to produce something that would kill you without actually killing you. Chemically might be the solution. We don't necessarily know the solution, but there was something fire-breathing. Context demands it. It's not something we see today. It could be a Leviathan. And of course, the question that always arises is, what happened to them? Standard answer is, well, they died 65 million years ago, never walked with man. And that is totally biblically incompatible. So what happened to them? Let's think about the biblical record. So two of every kind went on the ark. All those kinds that didn't make it, or the members of the kinds that, you know, that weren't part of the select two, died in the flood. Geographically, we know where those, that big barge landed, on the mountains of Ararat. So somewhere in the Middle East. Still debate whether that's in Turkey. John Morris, I think, has done 13 expeditions to Mount Ararat to try to find the ark, yet unsuccessful. A lot of interesting eyewitness testimony. Some say this might be a post-flood volcano. Russ Humphreys has argued from Genesis 11 that maybe it's somewhere in Iran. Unclear, but it's somewhere in the Middle East, it appears. And of course, the key event that follows this, another judgment of God, and we'll discuss this more Sunday evening. He doesn't recreate, he doesn't destroy a flood, he promised no more flood. He instead confuses the languages to the act of rebellion at Babel, Genesis 11. This spreads out mankind. Okay, now we can start thinking about what happened to the dinosaurs after the ark landed. They disembarked by their families, and then Scripture is silent, except for this event with people. Now, this question often arises as well. What about the continent? Seems like South America fits into Africa quite nicely. Is this a problem for young Earth? So the old Earth and evolutionary thinking is, well, continents today are slowly splitting. They assume present rates are the past, therefore they say these continents take millions of years to split. Well, if you assume that in the past there was a catastrophe, like the Bible said, you can have these guys splitting, smashing during the flood. No problem. You don't have to have present rates being the key to the past. So the current young Earth view among many is that the continents, this isn't continental drift, there was continental sprint during the flood, once or twice, so that the world we see today is probably unlike the world that Adam and Eve saw. The world that Noah landed on is probably like ours today and different from the one he disembarked, different from the one when he initially got on the ark. Now, people landed somewhere in the Middle East here, mountains of Ararat. They chose to stay together instead of dispersing like God commanded. God forced them to disperse through confusing their languages. Kind of hard to marry and maintain a culture with someone who doesn't speak to you. So this would have given rise to the different races, and this is perfectly genetically plausible. It's not like they're different races as if someone was separately created. They all go back to the people at Babel. And there's very little genetic difference among all of us. There's very little genetic difference among the races. Think of skin color. It's not that Africans have a different genetic code than we do. They just have a different amount of melanin. We have very little melanin if you're Caucasian. And Sudanese have a lot of melanin. That's the difference. There's no difference in worth or value. They're all equally created in the eyes of God. One human race. But what about the creatures? God told them, if I remember right, to be fruitful and multiply. What would have happened to the dinosaurs? So thinking carefully along these lines, dinosaurs probably would have gotten off the ark and spread around the globe. It could be that people took dinosaurs with them. How do we know this? Well, let's ask this question. Why are marsupials primarily in Australia? Why not elsewhere? Well, we know they would have gotten there from Ararat somehow, probably gone down this way. Maybe people took them. Maybe people took dinosaurs with them. What's really fascinating is that we see evidence of human-dinosaur interactions long before the present age, different cultures around the world. Just a few examples. Here's a temple in Cambodia dated about 1000 AD. So this is 1000 years old. You see this carving on the wall. Zoom in. It's got plates that make it look like a stegosaurus. Now, dinosaur bones weren't discovered until about 1850s, so less than two centuries. How are these people, far removed from modern science and Western culture, going to know what a stegosaurus looked like long before Westerners discovered dinosaur bones? Maybe they saw one. Here's a burial stone from Peru. There's a guy's feet carved, smoking a pipe, sitting on top of, well, it looks like a three-horned triceratops. How are they going to know what a triceratops looks like? Uninfluenced by Western culture and Western science. Probably they saw one. And there's all sorts of stuff like this around the globe. That raises the question, how did the dinosaurs get to South America? How did they get to Cambodia. Easy to get to Cambodia, just walk there. But how do you cross the Atlantic to get here? For that matter, how did the marsupials go from here to the island of Australia? We might notice something unusual about this map, all this ice here and here. It's supposed to depict what the world may have looked like during an ice age. The problem for the evolutionists is they don't know what would cause an ice age and what would stop it. They don't have the right conditions. The flood actually is the best explanation, probably the only explanation, for the existence of an ice age. You need warm winters so that snow falls, too cold and won't fall, and cooler summers so it doesn't melt away. And one of the guys in staff at ICR just retired, Larry Vardaman, has made a lot of his life's work in creation ministry, modeling just specifically how you could get snowfall being dumped on the continents. And one of the key factors seems to be ocean temperature. So he's been able to use like National Weather Service models of hurricanes and snowfall and other such weather activities and tweak the parameters slightly through heavy computing and show that you can get dramatic snowfall, dramatic weather, simply by tweaking the ocean temperature. Now, why would we think ocean temperature is a factor? Well, remember back to the flood. The windows of heaven open. The fountains of the great deep break open. We saw Mount St. Helens. A lot of catastrophe when a volcano erupts. Probably a lot of volcanic activity. That's going to release heat. So, immediately post-flood, after all that breaking up of the fountains of the great deep, you probably have got a warmer ocean than what we see today. Flood has stopped, fountains of the Great Deep have closed, so that source of heat shut off, so they've been cooling since then. Anyways, so if you model warmer temperature in the oceans than what we see today, you'll get more snowfall. You can show that by computer. Of course, snowfall, or this ice here, an ice sheet, is frozen water. It's going to have a source. So if we're thinking post-flood, windows of heaven are shut, fountains of the Great Deep, done. The most logical source is the oceans, evaporation from the oceans, then precipitation on the land. So the result here is the net movement of water from oceans to land, which is going to drain the oceans slightly, make them drop. It's going to expose land that otherwise might be submerged. And so with an ice age immediately post-flood, you can connect the continents, probably down here. And if you can't connect it exactly, they might just float over. Now, animals floating and recolonizing an island has been observed in modern history. I think it was Krakatoa, one of these islands down here in Southeast Asia, that decimated an island. Nothing left. And now it's prosperous again, biologically speaking. And creatures where birds, of course, can fly over. Lizards and such can float over on plant debris. And that's been one of the major hypotheses put forth in the near Earth community. Why are species distributed in the way they are geographically around the globe? Some of it may match prevailing ocean currents. It's not going to take that long to... So the flood has just destroyed all life, land life, in the flood. Mount St. Helens destroyed the forest and dumped all that plant material, all those trees, in Spirit Lake. So it's not a stretch to think that there was massive amounts of plant material floating around post-flood. Lots of stuff to float on, one way of colonizing the earth. But what about big guys like Triceratops? They might have simply walked over there across these land bridges. We don't see them today, again, because the cause is the warm ocean. Caused, ultimately, by the fountains of the Great Deep. Those were shut. Ocean now has been cooling since then. Ice Age was probably 300 years after the flood. Now has receded. And as we discussed yesterday, this will, of course, dramatically change your interpretation of the meaning and significance of global warming. There was a lot of global warming much greater in times past. So, what happened to those dinosaurs? We know how to get them now across the globe to Peru. They're with these people here in Peru, in South America, with people in Cambodia. Why aren't they with people today? Well, they might be. The BBC sent a team. There's been enough reports of some sauropod-like creature down here that the BBC sent a team to investigate not too long ago. There are still reports, interviews with people in Papua New Guinea, or down here in Southeast Asia, of some pterodactyl-like creature that apparently likes to pick off children. So there may be some alive today in the remotest parts of the earth that we can't yet explore. But on that note of pteranodons picking off children, here's an explanation the evolutionists will never invoke, which may be the real explanation. So why do species go extinct today? Why do they make the endangered species list? Usually because of human activity. By the way, we can talk long and hard about conservation in light of the this concept of kinds, which I won't at the moment. So people may have been the cause of their extinction, or, if there's still some alive today, near extinction, something the evolutionists will never think of. So, we've just covered this enormous topic, putting together all the pieces that we learned and last night and this morning, and we can tell a complete story about dinosaurs. This is not a problem for the creation model, and it's ridiculous for Bill Nye to say that dinosaurs somehow disprove the creation model. The Bible gives a fantastic explanation. When did they live? Very clearly, not longer than 6,000 to 10,000 years ago. Because the Bible says that's when it all started. That's when the beginning was. Same time with man. They ate plants in the beginning, and as an act of judgment, bloodshed entered. The exact biological mechanism is still a matter of fascinating research, fascinating to me. They began to kill each other after the curse. Most of them probably died in the flood. That's why we see their fossils. Two of every kind of dinosaur went on the ark. Two of every kind came off, lived with man post-flood. May still be some alive today if we hadn't hunted them to extinction. So there's the answer on dinosaurs. The book I didn't get to mention earlier, this book on the fossil record, discusses what I mentioned earlier about the facts of the fossil record and more, along with the young earth. We got a new book out, just came out, The Global Flood, that puts a lot of the sort of a layman's version of the original book that started the movement. Again, these books on young earth discuss the issues I raised, acts and facts. If you haven't done so, great resource. Websites, even more so. We do have a book on our website, if we still carry it, dinosaur book. If we don't have it, one of the sister organizations has a book on dinosaurs for kids, which us adults like too. But you want to avail yourself of that. Thank you so much for your attention and braving the storm. I'm going to stop here.